Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. You know, today we have a very important social issue in our culture that receives little press or really any kind of attention at all, except for those people in the middle of it. And that issue is the care for our aging population, especially those that require medical, professional, or just more personal care. On today's show, we have gerontologist and dedicated advocate of society's disenfranchised, Dr. Jackie DuPont. Jackie is so uniquely gifted. She demonstrates that oh-so-rare combination of superior intelligence with an overwhelming heart of compassion. On this episode of The Next Chapter with Charlie, Jackie guides me through the critical issues of dementia and other disabilities common to the people in those closing chapters of aging, and she offers insights in how adult children can manage these issues. The first thing Jackie suggests is to find in our hearts to recognize both the humanity and the dignity of all human beings. Our podcast today is one of the most insightful shows I feel that we have ever done. So let's bring on Dr. Jackie DuPont. Jackie DuPont, welcome to The Next Chapter with Charlie.
Hi, Charlie. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you here. I'm so excited to have you on the show today, Jackie. Among other things that I want to talk about, I do want to talk about your new PhD dissertation on the growing issue of ageism in America. And ageism is a problem that is going to become even more prevalent, I think, in our society. But I want to come back to that, and since we're going to focus on that, before we even get into our conversation, Jackie, I think our listeners would like to know a bit. I would like to hear even a bit more from you about your professional history. I'm calling it an entrepreneurial gerontologist. Do you like that?
Oh, that's great.
It kind of defines you, don't you think? I mean, defines that part of
oh,
your.
Yeah.
It doesn't define you. It defines that part of your portfolio. You're a philanthropist, and you're just a contributor on so many boards of schools and charitable organizations. You serve the community so well. So tell me, Jackie, when you meet someone, how do you describe what you do to that person? No, not what you do to that person. How do you describe to that person what you do?
Oh, goodness. Well, you know, it's so funny. On the East Coast, when you go to dinner, what do you do for a living? On the West Coast, how are you doing? It's so funny to see the different perspectives. I've been spending a lot of time on the East Coast, and I do get asked it quite often. Usually I'll say gerontologist, because that's really what my professional background's in. But then also, of course, I'll expand that I've been in the senior care industry for over 25 years, and that encompasses home health and home care and memory care and assisted living.
How much of your time now do you spend with the elderly? I mean, I look at your schedule and you've got so many things going. So what would you say is the amount of time that you spend
not as much as I like to. I miss them so, as a group, I miss them so much. So probably less now, just because I donated my company, Irvine Cottages, that was a chain of memory care facilities, to Alzheimer's Orange County. And we had a smooth transition during COVID, unfortunately. And that was in July. So I stayed on a little bit helping on giving advice and counseling, but I had so much fun last week because I did get to go out and do an assessment with an older adult, a really fascinating man named Alex. Of course, I can't tell you his real name, but he escaped Auschwitz at 2 years, 7 months, dug under the gate. His mom kind of pointed him down in with no clothes on. Not even 3 years old, dug under the gate and ran, and they shot at him and missed. And he grew up in like 6 different orphanages and never knew his name because, he only knew his first name. But his story was so fascinating, and I miss those stories. You know, there's just no replacing it. There's no movie, no book that can replace an older adult's wisdom or history. You know, his history was just fascinating. And he was caring for his wife with Alzheimer's and so intrinsically motivated to get her the best care. And I think it came from his hardship. You know, as I listened to him, he had such a different perspective as a caregiver, caring for her at home, than most. And that's why I asked
What would his perspective be, Jackie, that was different?
It was just different. It was, he said, you know, I am going to miss her more than she's going to miss me if I place her. And I don't think I've ever heard a spouse say that. They're usually at their wits' end, and they are so tired. They've been up all night for how many weeks usually, and there's been a change. Or they wouldn't be looking for placement, such as assisted living or memory care. There's been usually an issue that's come up, or decline, or I just can't do it anymore. It's such a hard job. But in his case, it was, no, I love the job. I love caring for her. I love taking her to the bathroom. I love showering her. I love it all. But she might be missing out on, you know, other stimulation, activities, memory care, art stuff. You know, she loved art. And I said, well, have you tried bringing that in? He said, I don't know if I could take people in my home. So there are all these different dynamics going on. But he had this really interesting perspective on him being lonely without her. So fast forward, I checked in on him last week and said, I heard you placed your wife. How do you feel? He goes, I'm devastated. She's not. She's doing great. But I'm devastated. I think I might have to bring her home. And I should have listened to you because you said to first try a caregiver at home and then try the transition, you know, so I could get used to it. But you're the only one who told me it's going to be harder on me, and it's actually harder on me, so I think I might bring her home. And I said, well, why don't you give it another week? You know, it's been hard through COVID with these families. It's just so hard. So he gave it another week, and I called him today, and he said, you know what, I'm going to keep her there and just visit, like you said, at the same time, and maybe help with eating, you know, bringing her some snacks, or help, you know, taking her outside on the patio and helping with her meals, because that makes him feel useful. So we went over useful tips, and he's such an interesting man, and I really miss those stories of his life. He wrote a book, a biography, and he just finished it. I don't know if he's going to publish it.
How old is he?
You know, he's, I can't recall. Was he 82?
Oh, okay.
82. He was two at Auschwitz. So, yeah, that's about right. 82, 83.
So tell me, Jackie, what, you know, you are so interested in the elderly. What drew you to this, to the care of the elderly? Was it something personal, or is it just something that you're...
Yeah, it was definitely personal, Charlie, because I took care of my grandfather with Alzheimer's when it was called senile dementia or organic brain syndrome, was the term we used to use. And he and I were very close, and I'm from a Greek family, and we have our older adults, even aunts, uncles, you know, especially grandparents, with the family usually. So the multi-generational philosophy was there growing up, and I was always around my grandparents. And that just, I mean, it was not even a problem to go to the nursing home at 12 and spend hours there and volunteer, because I had been around a lot of older people where my friends had it. And I think that's been a shift to tie in with the ageism, because we're always thinking, well, why is there ageism? Why is there discrimination against older people, especially older people with dementia? And, you know, one gap or one, you know, I think thought of analysis would be to really analyze what happened in our country once we became more of a nuclear family and the multi-generational families have diminished quite a bit. That is one theory.
I can remember Pam and I in Italy one time, and I think it was our driver, and I don't know if it was a taxi driver or a tour driver, but he explained that he lived at home with his parents and grandparents, and they had been in this home for, you know, decades, and they had a farm there that they took care of, and if he had children, he just planned to stay at that home. You know, he didn't. There was no moving. This was our family home, and that concept. I mean, we don't even stay in one house as a nuclear family, for crying out loud, let alone having extended families doing it.
Especially Hispanic families seem to have their grandparents at home still, and Asian families of all kinds, they still value having grandparents close by. And if you travel to even very educated parts of Ecuador or Peru and undereducated, it doesn't matter, they have their grandparents at home still. So I think we've lost that, and that's sad because our younger population should get those intergenerational benefits, you know, of understanding the value of an older person in their family and how important they are.
Yeah, what are grandparents now in our culture, except babysitters? That I continue to hear, you know, we're not grandparents yet, but I continue to hear people say that it's like having a child without the responsibility. You can always get, mm-hmm. you know, you can get rid of them. It's like you can get rid of them, you know. It's there's not this, you know, interfamily connection that you're talking about.
Yeah, but you know, there could be if they were maybe consistently babysitting. That's probably a beautiful bond they're building. At least they're around. You know, a lot of grandparents live really far away. So maybe with the decentralization of cities and urbanization, we've just moved far away from each other. So it's a little harder to have that bond. And that, you know, and I would have done anything for my grandparents. They just were amazing people. And they worked so hard. And hearing about my grandfather coming over from Greece and having to sell oranges on the street. And, you know, those stories are just with you forever. I hope those don't get lost. Just hearing Alex again was so nice. So to answer your question, yes, I do miss being hands-on. But I'm still working with my in-home care company, so that keeps me busy. And that's such a different type of care for the elderly in that they, you know, older adults have caregivers in the home. And with COVID, it seems like most people preferred to be at home. They didn't want to do rehabilitation at a nursing home. They didn't want to go to a nursing home. I mean, not that anyone really wants to. But sometimes you need to due to a broken hip or rehabilitation. Right. And it seemed like that was getting less and less popular. So people have now gone to in-home care, which is a beautiful thing, except it's really expensive, especially in California.
Oh, it's more expensive than going to a home?
To a facility.
To a facility.
Much more expensive.
But also, you know what we have, without having the internet, the intergenerational relationship, we don't have the it's almost as if adult children don't want to be bothered with the care of their aging children or their aging parents. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying they don't love them, but you know, it's like we have our own lives to live, and I just don't have time for this. And and you know, do you find yourself dealing with that?
We forget what they did for us. You know, we really do. And it used to be as professionals in the field, we'd always talk and say, gosh, you know, that family that was just admitted, that daughter never visits. I bet they had a horrible relationship. I bet she just didn't get along with her mom. And I'd say, no, we don't know the story. She might have five kids at home. She might be a working mom with so much on her mind. And I think it's hard to judge, but because of the need and the cost of living that are so crazy, our younger generation's having a hard time, you know, caring for their parents. But, you know, recently my dad's had his house remodeled, and I've had him here, and it's been so wonderful just to have him here. You've even seen him here when you came by. And it really does make a difference with my kids. Like, they need to see that he has a walker. They need to see that, hey, we got to be a little more patient. And I wish he lived here all the time. It would actually be a little easier. I do. It would just be so nice. Because you know, your parents miss a lot, too, when they're not near you. You miss a lot of their lives, and they miss a lot of ours. But daughters and sons are trying so hard, I feel, lately, just seeing so many trying to advocate more. They really are trying to step it up. And even if they place them, it's not they're placing them because they don't love them or they don't have time. Not always the time factor, sometimes. But sometimes it's that they don't have the expertise.
Precisely. So
it's that terror, fear, threat. Like, maybe I don't have the self-efficacy to do this. I'm not a trained nurse, or I might miss something, or maybe a facility would be better, especially in the case of Alzheimer's disease, which is such a difficult disease to manage at home. Other diseases such as Parkinson's, Huntington's, diabetes, you know, even osteoporosis, you could have all these comorbidities and be fine at home. But when it comes to Alzheimer's disease, it takes a toll on everyone. You know, they don't sleep. They could pace. They could become agitated. So it is a tougher disease to have at home. So I don't know if there's as much of a choice of what you're talking about,
right,
if that makes sense.
Right.
You know,
it could be better. What would be the percentage of people that have of the elderly? You know, how many people have these mental health issues like Alzheimer's?
Well, now in Orange County, we have, 80,000 Alzheimer's patients. So we have grown leaps and bounds, but it's as you get to 85, unfortunately, half of the population has some form of dementia at 85 years old. And some of it's mild. You know, you might have a mild form of dementia, just where the person has short-term memory loss and mild cognitive impairment. They might need to be reminded a lot. They may not be able to take their medications and need reminders. Those are mild cases. But then some people do get Alzheimer's disease, which is a form of dementia that is a much more difficult disease. At 85, you're really at risk.
Is there something?
Up to 85, it could be less.
Okay, Jackie. Here's a question that I'm sure some listeners are considering, especially the ones that are maybe not that many that are my age, but that are getting closer. I'm 71. What do I need to be doing now that I can ensure, or I can mitigate me being an Alzheimer patient at 85 years old?
Well, that's a great question. So there are things you can do, and your physician should be at least, are you doing a physical once a year, or having that heart to heart? Yeah. Once a year, you need to talk about the risk of dementia once you get about 65, to say, I don't want to get this. What are some things I could do? And they're probably going to tell you to exercise, to eat right. The Mediterranean diet is famous for healthy aging, and the blue
tell me the Mediterranean diet. Grapes and wine.
Yeah, so you might want to check your D level. So older adults with low D do get dementia, and we find that it's a very big risk factor. So your vitamin D level should be analyzed, and if it's low, take a supplement. But not if it's not low, only if it is. And then take a folate B12 test to see what that level is. If it's low, you have to take it because that's a risk factor with getting dementia. And then another risk factor would be fish oil. What's your DHA EPA level? Is it high? Is it low? You need to take a prescription fish oil, whichever one your physician believes is appropriate.
Holy cow, Jackie! You're sounding like a doctor here with all these terms. I have no.
Sorry, I'm so used to hearing it from all of our physicians that order for our wonderful residents.
I was just teasing. Go ahead, please go ahead.
No, so there's great physicians who know a lot about dementia, and there are some that know nothing. So if you have one that doesn't know much, you might want to look around for one that deals more with older adults and knows to check D level and B12 and folate and thyroid. So if your thyroid is off, you could get memory loss. And so there are things that mask dementia, and those are reversible versus irreversible dementia. We kind of categorize as gerontologists into those two ways. So the irreversible ones, you want to, of course, those are sad and terrible, but the reversible ones, such as vitamin B12 deficiency, folate deficiency, thyroid deficiency, those can be corrected, or water on the brain. That's called hydrocephalus. So hydrocephalus, water on the brain, can mask Alzheimer's, and you will get the exact same symptoms. You'll look at an older adult and say, oh, he has Alzheimer's, but his eyes may be watering, and he may be leaning and shuffling with his feet. Those are signs of hydrocephalus that Alzheimer's patients don't often have. But in any way, the doctor should be ruling those things out with a CAT scan or MRI to say, okay, your dad has changed recently, but he has some watery eyes, and we want to rule that out. So a good physician does a really great ruling out process and does an MRI, but there are some physicians that do nothing, and that's when we get into ageism. And we see physicians who just say, well, your mom probably has Alzheimer's. There's nothing we can do about it. Well, that's not true. There are medications for memory loss and Alzheimer's. And there is a ruling out process to diagnose it that we just talked about. We want to look at irreversible and reversible causes to memory loss. And how can we make sure we're not giving a blanket diagnosis? Doctors aren't doing that. And not discriminating against older people. Because really poor medical care toward an older adult, especially with dementia, is discrimination. We shouldn't be doing that to them. They can't speak for themselves. So we need to assist that older adult who has the disease and make sure we're doing a great workup on them.
So Jackie, why would a doctor do that? Why is it just, I hate to use the word laziness because doctors work so hard, but is it just?
It could be, there's so many theories. One is terror threat. Like they may feel terrorized that they don't have the knowledge, or they could be fearing their own, you know, aging process. They could be fearing getting Alzheimer's, and family members could be the same way. So they may ignore it. They ignore the symptoms. They're in denial because they don't want to go there. So they're fearful. It could also be that physicians are very busy. And one study showed that physicians would rather take on any disease. They went through AIDS, Huntington's, all these diseases, except Alzheimer's. That was the last disease they wanted to take as a patient. This was an AMA study. Another study showed that med students rarely do they say, I want to be in geriatric medicine. Rarely. It's the last pick. So
no
I think
kidding.
It's because Alzheimer's patients are so difficult to, they take more time, a lot more time. I just told you they have to rule out all these things. They have to, make sure the family's okay. They have to give great suggestions like you need to maybe stop driving. It's such a harder job as a physician, I assume, to take on an Alzheimer's patient than someone with normal aging.
How do they even
normally
measure,
aging?
How do they measure success? I mean, is it?
Well,
it
I think
seems
they measure
like
success
so
with comfort.
Okay, go ahead.
They see an older adult who's comfortable. They're helping the family, maybe giving them referrals to Alzheimer's Orange County or support groups. I think if they've tried their best to really advocate for each patient they have with Alzheimer's, as a doctor, I think they feel good about it, even if they're declining, because they're really helping the family and then helping the person through it. And they're not over-treating or under-treating. They're really trying to keep with the wishes of that person. But it must be a very tough job as a physician. I'm sure they really struggle with it. But we need to maybe make some changes. Maybe Medicare needs to pay them more money. I mean, it's hard. It's definitely harder than a normal aging patient, again, who just needs their labs drawn and their urine checked. I mean, they really require much more care and supervision with the family and communication. So I think it's harder on doctors. And they're also fearful of getting sued. And we do find when there's a family involved, and there could be the three G's involved. We call them the three G's in senior care. They're terrible. Greed, guilt, and grief. And greed, guilt, and grief. And families will often sue for greed, guilt, and grief doctors. So poor physicians get beat up. And I think it's a little scary. So there's that terror threat, too. Like, do I really want to take on this case that could sue me? Because I missed something. And how do they miss something? The older adult can't communicate. So it's a very hard job. So I don't the ageism I see with some physicians is maybe a protection. They're trying to put up a protection wall.
Got
like, I can't, you know, I'm so afraid.
I think we have failed to define ageism. You know, I'm thinking it's just about getting old, but you're talking about it very specifically. And what I want to do is I want to take a break. And then right after our break, let's come back and let's define ageism so we're all on the same page with that concept.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Sure.
Hang in. Just a few seconds. Hi, you're listening to Charlie Hedges in the Next Chapter with Charlie and my special guest, Dr. Jackie DuPont, who we are talking today. She is a gerontologist, a philanthropist, charity board member, who knows what all. But today we're talking about her as a gerontologist. We're talking about gerontology, and we're talking about ageism, and we've been referring to that during the first half, but we really have not defined what Jackie means by ageism. So, Jackie, can you give me that definition of ageism?
Sure. Well, ageism is typically defined as a prejudice or discrimination on the grounds of a person's age. So it's basically you're discriminating against this person based on their age only. An often cited area of ageism is in HR, human resources,
right.
That people feel ageism in recruitment, specifically in hiring, is a problem. And it is. It is. You hear it quite often. Well, I'm older. I don't think I'm going to get hired. And it's. I think people feel they don't look at, gosh, you know, older workers are the best. I mean, I've had the best success with older workers. They are on time. They care. They have maturity. They don't call out sick.
Do you remember that movie? I believe it was De Niro. I believe it was Bob De Niro who went as a secretary. He was like 60 years old, and he went into the job as a secretary, and he turned out to be the best secretary.
Intern.
What's that?
He was an intern.
He was an intern.
That's right.
But it was such a good portrayal of what an older person, the value that an older person can bring to the job environment, to the work environment.
Right.
And it was, you know, Bob De Niro was really great in that.
He kind of felt in that movie the stereotype. That's how we think. And the prejudice, which is how we feel. And the discrimination is how we act. So when you break down ageism,
prejudice is how you feel. And
I feel like stereotyping is how you think, like
okay.
You're stereotyping in your brain, which is terrible, sometimes verbally too. Then prejudice is how you feel, and discrimination is how you act toward others based on age.
Now, Jackie, you're writing a dissertation. You're doing your second PhD.
Yeah.
I know one wasn't enough. But you're writing on ageism. What kinds of, you know, I'm sure you're out there and you have, well, in your field, you have seen lots of examples, but in your research, you've seen lots of examples. Give me a couple examples of what this ageism looks like in real life. You know, we've defined it technically, but what does it look like in a family situation or a work situation, either one?
Okay, well, gosh, I'll say in a family situation, you might be taking your dad to the doctors, you know, you're assisting, hey, dad, I want to go with you, because you're thinking his memory isn't as good as it used to be. And you walk in, and the doctor looks at you, the daughter or the son, and says, oh, how's dad doing? And your dad's sitting right there. So I always say, please don't treat them like they're dead. So they are in the room. Even if someone is so impaired, maybe they're late stage Alzheimer's and you're going to the doctors, you can't talk about them in front of them, because then you're not acknowledging them, that they're in the room, right? So even if they're very impaired, when I go to do an assessment, I will say, "Hi, Mr. Smith, how are you? My name's Jackie. I'm here to assess your situation, or I want to get to know you," because maybe that might give them some fear. So maybe assessment's a bad word, but I'll say, "I want to get to know you." And he may not even be able to speak two words. And I know that, I can tell, but I'm still going to ask him, how are you doing? And if he doesn't say anything back, he might blink at me, whatever. It doesn't matter. You still have to acknowledge that person.
And you can
always tell a physician who is compassionate, kind, and loving toward older adults. And I have one, I don't know, I'm probably not allowed to use names, but he's a superstar, Dr. Abney.
Tell us who a superstar is.
Yeah, he's a superstar gerontologist or geriatrician, and he does house calls. Now, a physician that does house calls, you have to think to yourself, he's getting paid by Medicare very little to drive to someone's home to care for them. He's not a concierge. He doesn't charge extra. He doesn't care. He goes in that home, spends double the time in a doctor's visit. In California, house calls are paid for. And it's so nice that we have doctors that'll do it. But you can tell from the minute he comes in to see your mom, he just looks at her and asks how she's doing. Like I just gave you the example. And then he'll say, "Is it okay?" Say, "Gertrude, can I talk to your daughter about some of your issues lately?" So that's just a kind way of doing it. But an insensitive person looks over them, you know, talks over them. Another example of ageism is the doctor over-treating, maybe over-ordering tests, putting them through a lot for financial gain, or under-treating. "Well, your mom just has dementia. There's nothing we can do about it. Why do you want to test her urine?" Well, maybe you don't want your mom to suffer with a urinary tract infection with dementia, and she can't tell you. They don't get the same symptoms. They get agitated and violent with a urinary tract infection. Wouldn't it be better to treat that with an antibiotic than her going to the ER and then going to the nursing home and then going to the rehab center? I mean, under-treating costs us billions of dollars. We think $3 billion a year on ageism, on under-treating. Because if we treated
Seriously.
That older adult, you know, they wouldn't have to go to the ER. And Medicare then has to pay that, right? And the family. Those are examples we consider ageism.
It sounds to me like, in my simplified terms, or my simple terms, not simplified, but my simple terms is, it's really simply a matter, but it's a matter of humanizing. This is dehumanizing people. This is making them like non-existent. And what you're suggesting is to acknowledge their presence, to acknowledge their humanity, and that they are still human beings, and we're not treating them, we're not acting as such.
Right. And by the way, this can happen to any person, maybe a person in a wheelchair. You know, I had a girlfriend who was a speech therapist, and she said, "Jackie, I fell and broke my hip." Now, she's young, like 60. She said, "But I experienced ageism." I said, "What? Where? You're so young." She said, "Well, I was in the hospital, and because I hadn't dyed my hair, I had no makeup on, and I felt very frail, and my diabetes kicked in, and I looked terrible. I really felt like the physical therapist was like, 'Oh, can you really participate today, or should I go on to the next patient?'" She said that the physical therapist really said that to her, and I felt like they looked at me like I was out of it, and instead of encouraging me and being patient. And then when I got into my walker, finally, and I had to use a walker for about, you know, 2 weeks, people totally ignored me, looked at me differently. I was at the mall, and they were embarrassed to look at me. It's just, I feel it's a humanity problem, like you just said. It's definitely a problem of compassion, a lack of compassion, a lack of, you know, dignity, right?
I think dignity is a big word, a huge word in what we're talking about. But there's something else I'm thinking about, another cause. I can feel this in myself when I'm with somebody who is incapacitated somehow. I feel helpless, that I don't even know how to approach them. What, you know, I'm not educated, and you know, I feel like I don't even know what I would say, how I would say it, you know, without being without falling into some politically incorrect position. You know, I'm sort of at a loss. We, you know, you had earlier, when we had talked earlier on the phone, you talked about educating and training of adult children and other people of what it means to be in a wheelchair or in a walker or God forbid, to have dementia.
Yeah, I think that sensitivity training is so important. And usually people who end up becoming a caregiver do reach out to their local chapter of, you know, either Alzheimer's, or there's great, there's other charities who also do a really fabulous job educating. One charity has a training program called, what is it, Savvy Caregiver. I think it might have started in New York, but it's all over, and I think you can even get it online now. But you end up becoming that savvy caregiver, the advocate. And I think it's people who just are fearful of dementia. Of course, it is a very complicated disease, and you don't want to say the wrong thing or hurt that person or trigger them. What about triggering them? Agitation.
Right.
That's also, I'm sure that's a fear, and the fear you are feeling. So you do feel that way. But, you know, there definitely is a person inside, and we don't know how much they don't know. So I always err on treat them normal and use laughter. I always like to say, oh, my gosh, I love your hair. I wish I could have your hair. Or I make fun of myself, and they laugh. And I think just really trying to treat them normally is really what tends to work. When we start to slow down or speak really loud, or we're trying so hard, and I do see people trying, but they're actually making it worse.
My goodness.
So they sense fear, too. I think people who are vulnerable sense fear.
Oh, of course. You know, I say of course because it just feels obvious to me that you would sense that fear or reluctance, or sometimes that could be interpreted as a lack of care, and it's really not a lack of care, it's ignorance.
Right.
It's not that I'm not compassion. I just don't know what to do. I don't know how to handle it. And what was the name of that you said it may be online now? What was the name of that again?
A Savvy Caregiver.
I love the name. That's a great name.
SAVVY.
Yeah.
Caregiver training. I think it's still. Oh, it's online. Yeah, it is.
I'll have to make sure I put that in the show notes.
Savvy Caregiver training.
Savvy Caregiver.
There's so much. Yeah, here it's called the Savvy 2Vs Caregiver Program. Family Caregiver Alliance offers it. A lot of different charities do. I know Alzheimer's Orange County had in-person.
Now, you're
Savvy
involved
caregiver
with
classes. Oh, it looks like LA's offering it too. Oh, that's good.
That's great.
Alzheimer's Los Angeles.
Now, aren't you involved with Alzheimer's Orange County?
I am. I've been a board member for so long, they probably stopped counting. I know I did after 20 years. A long time. I love the charity. They do so much good.
What do they do?
Well, we have adult daycare centers that are, you know, adult daycare is another option for older adults with memory loss or that need stimulation. And, you know, with the cost of facility care and in-home care, adult daycare is covered by Medicaid, especially for people who are low income. And then it's also covered with discounts and other ways. It's just so affordable. So you think of child daycare, we don't like to think of it as that. We like to even call it sometimes adult day or adult health, or because the word daycare can be demeaning.
Right,
but it's really
right.
A day program that has a beautiful interactive program, such as music and art. And there's professionals there. There's physical therapists and exercisers. And
oh, my goodness.
It's a really great program. And so
I think I want to go now, Jackie. It sounds fun.
Oh yeah, you don't qualify. You don't really need the help, but you know what? Senior centers are similar to that, and that, for example, Oasis or Irvine or Florence Sylvester and Laguna Woods, they have these amazing senior centers. Those are for people without impairment. But adult daycare fulfills the need of that family going to work, and again, hoping there's intergenerationalist going on. Maybe mom's living at home with the family, so they can drop off your loved one, and then pick them up later. So we offer two of those adult daycares.
Alzheimer's
Orange County.
Yeah.
And they're expensive to run. Very, very expensive. And we lose money, of course, on them because they are. And it doesn't matter. That's what charity is about. It's fulfilling that need for the community. And they also get a great meal while they're there. So it's a wonderful need. And then we own now Irvine Cottages, which was my company I donated, and they're running all of the facilities I donated, and they're doing a fabulous job. I'm so proud of what they've done. And they run that program.
And how many facilities? COVID, that was several facilities, wasn't it, Jackie?
Yeah, several. And they're adding three more. And they also opened, Alzheimer's Orange County opened a COVID positive facility through the county, the cities, and just did a fabulous job. And they have support groups. I think we have over 50, I mean, a lot of support groups for families that are free, where they can go get really great knowledge and information and share experiences with a leader. And they have counseling at the office in Irvine.
That's tremendous.
Some families who are more, I would say, not getting along or having conflict, have conflict resolution classes. We have a social worker to help them.
Let's hang out there for a bit. I want to hang out with and we can probably wrap up our time doing this, but it will take a few minutes, so I'm not in a hurry. I want to talk about families, adult children caring for their elderly parents that are somehow dealing with the issues
conflict.
Of age. And then there's the conflict in the family. You know, I have personal experience with that, and it's the stories are horrendous, Jackie, of what's going on in families. And you suggested that education is essential, but it begins long before the parents even begin the aging process, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really does. So I find that over the years, that families, even the closest of families, can have conflicts in a crisis. So the crisis of caring for mom or dad or spouse or sister, brother, whoever has the disease, just exacerbates what's been going on for years. So could be you have these parents that never communicated their wishes. They didn't even do a will. They might not have done a power of attorney, so that's a conflict. Or you might have parents who are very controlling and didn't want to talk about who's the power of attorney. There wasn't that communication. But then we do see families where there is great communication. So I can't say it's all of them, but about 1 in 10 seems to have this terrible conflict between siblings, usually over money.
Yeah, isn't it with families that have the parents have money more than the ones that don't have money?
Definitely. But, you know, families without money sometimes have elder abuse as well. And when I say elder abuse, the number one abusers typically are adult children or children of parents. And I've seen horrific abuse where a lady in Newport Beach, she's blind, and her son, she said, "Can you look at this check for me?" And I said, "Sure, let me see your check. Can you read it?" I said, "Sure, it's $50,000. She goes, $50,000? I wrote my son a $5,000 check. And I looked, and you could tell he added the zeros.
Oh,
I said, "Where did you get the check?" She said, "I got a copy of it from the bank teller. And I'm really upset about it." I said, "Well, you have to, you know, you need to call the police, and we need to report this." And she said, "No, you cannot report my son. He'll go to jail." And, you know, it's just, You see the horrific abuse of children. You see some children who just say, let's place mom right now early because I need the home. I need to live here with my kids. Or you see, I don't want to spend that money on my parents. I don't want to put them in a facility that's nice because I want it for us. You know, basically, let's save the money. And they'll put them in the worst, cheapest facility just so they can, you know, inherit that money. And then you also see families who really are fabulous and don't do any of that. And they really honor their parents and know their wishes. And there was great communication. But unfortunately, dysfunction rises to heights when a bad crisis such as, you know, having to care for mom and dad occurs. So I think it's more prevalent in families, probably with money, of course. But
and
also
greed,
with families
greed
who
really
communicate
in.
Well.
Yeah, so if you've got money and you haven't communicated, then greed and selfishness take over, and what I need matters more than what anybody else, what my parents need or what my siblings need. I mean, it's just, I've seen it in more than one situation, you know, just even in my limited experience of it just breaking apart families, where families don't talk to each other. You know, they're no longer in communication whatsoever. And if something were done beforehand, if some kind of agreements were done beforehand, that's why, you know, my wife and I, you know, we're fortunate that we can afford estate planning, but we've done estate planning and we've laid that out. And we've talked to our son about, you know, about if something were to happen to both of us or either of us. And, you know, we did not, you know, that he would have power of attorney, and he knows how we stand on that. And I just can't, even then it could be difficult, but fortunately he doesn't, he's an only child, so he doesn't have any other siblings to have to wrestle with.
And I do find if you can create systems or groups or ways to communicate with families to be part of the treatment, even the children that aren't power of attorney, because then you get into, well, what, only Jane is power of attorney. The other two kids feel very left out. But if you can inform the entire family, if they'll allow it, you know, with HIPAA, and support everyone and kind of communicate more evenly, they do seem to get less upset. And offering ways for them to be useful in treatment, maybe the son brings in an out burger to mom once a week in the facility, and that's his job. And then the daughter says, well, I'm going to take her for a walk every time I go. And they kind of do this wonderful treatment plan together. And those seem like small things, but it's great to kind of get together and say, hey, I'll do the laundry, because we don't want the facility to do the laundry because things get lost or whatever. I don't want other people's clothing with my mom's. If you don't mind bringing in and out burger once a week and taking her to the park, whatever it is, when they get together and they delegate like that, they tend to support one another more. Because then you get the daughter who is so wonderful and so over the top, and then no one else is doing anything, just her.
Isn't that
really?
But
they're
either
going to feel jealous, or she's controlling, or why isn't she delegating? And so you have these dynamics that go on, and they're very complicated.
Is this what you're going to write about in Ageism, Jackie? Is this going to be included?
I don't know. But that's a whole nother paper, to be honest.
Is it?
You know, there's some of the stories with families you could just write a book on. You'll have one son who visits and he'll say, oh, here's a gift card for every caregiver. And then you'll have the daughter that comes in and says, my mom has the wrong blanket on. I told you guys to never use that blanket. And, you know, I think also families have unrealistic expectations of how their parents are going to age. They either feel it's going to be just easy and wonderful, or they're in reality. Like, okay, let's all help and know that the blanket doesn't matter. What matters is mom's care. Just like, you know, and it matters that we have the right caregiver for mom at home. It doesn't matter that they're African-American or whatever their race or ethnicity is. It doesn't matter. We're colorblind because we love all people and we want the best care. We don't care about, you know, that. But we wish everyone was like that, and they're not. Some families just have deep-seated problems, you know, or they have biases or prejudices, which makes things worse.
You know, Jackie, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this must have been two or three decades back. I saw a cartoon, and it was just a cartoon image with a caption below, and the image was a middle-aged man pushing a wheelbarrow, and in the wheelbarrow was an elderly man, and they were heading toward the trash dump. You know, you could see the smell and all coming from the trash dump. And a young boy was walking alongside the dad and the middle-aged dad. And the young boy, it was his voice that was the caption, and he said, "Gee, Dad, I'm so happy you're letting me go along on this trip. That way I know what to do with you when you get old."
Wow, talk about empathy. That was the teaching lesson. Don't you love that?
Oh, my goodness. That story, Jackie, stuck with me for decades. My takeaway, and tell me if you think my takeaways are appropriate, is that we have much more of an issue than most of us have ever thought. And looking at people as human beings and considering what I can do, especially if it's family, what I can do to help. And how can I be helpful and not a hindrance and not a troublemaker in this process?
Yeah, that's the best attitude. You know, treating them with dignity, like you said, and no matter what that person has going on, no matter what cognitive or physical impairment they may have, just treating them the way you'd want to be treated, and the way you want to be treated, like you said, with the wheelbarrow, the way you want to be treated by your children, you know?
Precisely. And we didn't get a chance to really dwell on it, but I just am so in agreement with you on dignity, that it is one of the greatest human needs. I mean, we do it with all of the disenfranchised people. I know you're familiar with the work we do in Africa, and that is one of the things we try to do in the village communities in Africa, is to give people a sense of dignity, not that they're being waited on, but that they get to take over and they own the process, and it is their process that they manage and they have responsibility. I think dignity is maybe one of the great things lacking in the United States right now, is people searching for and hurting for dignity. Jackie DuPont, you are an amazing human being. I'm so glad we've gotten to know each other, and thank you for taking the time to be with me on this show.
Oh, thank you, Charlie. You are too. I want to pick your brain someday so I can hear all these wonderful stories.
Well, they're not all wonderful, my friend. They are, there's the bad with the good, but
I bet.
But you are what you are based on who you've been. You know, I use the phrase all the time, you are who you have been becoming.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So, Jackie, you have been becoming a tremendous individual, and I love working with you, and I love having you on this show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a wonderful day.
I shall. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to the next chapter with Charlie. And remind you to check us out at our website. You know, you can always sign up and get weekly blogs, and you can get these podcasts in your email, and they both come out weekly. And once again, until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.